See you later, Mr. McKeown, called Daniel, loud enough to make me glance fearfully around for passing star pilots before boarding the vehicle. Warden gave me one last meaningful glance, then followed, taking the rear seat beside him. The tarantula settled on my shoulder again. Right, that'll increase the average property value of this district, said Henderson, still doing his fly-back-up. One more thing, Mr. McKeown, man to man. He gently but firmly spun me around until we were practically nose to orange nose, keeping one hand on my shoulder. Boss, I said. He grinned at my use of the word. He had rather unsettlingly white teeth. Jacques, I'm not a stupid man. I can see you've been, shall we say, ill at ease tonight. No, Mr. Henderson, really. Carlos's hand came down upon my free shoulder, and all the air blasted from my lungs, as if I'd suddenly been burdened with a rucksack full of bricks. My knees almost buckled. Don't call me a liar, Jacques, said Henderson, pressing down with his hand. A sharp pain blossomed out from my shoulder. You're nervous, I can tell. It's completely understandable, really. That wasn't what I'd intended to say, but the pain was making it hard to think. I'm asking you to take responsibility for my son's happiness and well-being, and it's completely understandable that you'd be nervous. Do you know what a cassowary is, Jacques?
Mangle.
It's something we have on Earth. You can look it up. I have a talon from a cassowary on my signet ring. Feel it? It wasn't breaking the skin, but it was less than a stone's throw from the threshold. Carlos's fingers flexed one by one, signalling me to respond. All I could do was nod. 1-2 more pounds of pressure, he said, leaning his face in closer. And then all I'd have to do is move my hand diagonally down to about belt level. He placed his free hand on my waist like a dance partner, then blew a short raspberry. And there you are. You're on the floor. Well, bits of you are, anyway. The pain had spread all the way to the fingertips of my left arm. I could feel them shaking. Carlos's hushed, hoarse breathing filled my ears. Henderson's face was like a little orange sun invading my personal space and pleasantly blasting the flesh from my bones. Then he stepped back, displaying his hands as if expecting a hug. The weight of Carlos's hand vanished so suddenly that my feet left the floor for a moment. And it's so good to know I won't have to do that, isn't it? Because Daniel and I are going to be very, very happy with the work you do for us. He sauntered past me and took the front passenger seat, as Carlos poured himself back through the driver's side window. Moments later, the car roared with unnecessary volume and sped off down Ritsuko's leg, scattering cyclists. I watched it go, waving like a theme park mannequin, dreamily rotating my forearm until the car was out of sight. Then I turned and ran. Chapter 6 I arrived back in the spaceport district, or Ritsuko's arse, as it was colloquially known, at a full sprint, scattering a small queue of late-night drunks who were waiting to use the Quantunnel booth. I wasn't even sure what I was in such a hurry for. I just knew that I had to be somewhere familiar and safe, a comfortably long distance from Ritsuko's plying leg. The spaceport was still open, of course. The day and night cycle from planet to planet would take a far better brain than mine to comprehend. And there were still a lot of pilots around. The night shift bunch were the ones who were convinced that there was more money in the drunken bachelor party crowd than the daytime tourists. But I'd never been convinced of that, and cleaning the cabin afterward was a nightmare. I paused in the receiving area where the old concourse connected to the new one. My first instinct was to head for the old spaceport, get aboard my ship, set a course for the nearest pirate hangout, and sign up, completing whatever admission procedure was necessary with a slightly pained smile on my face. Alternatively, I could calm down and think for 5 seconds. Just because I had been tacitly threatened with disembowelment by a very orange man, that didn't mean I had to abandon the solar system altogether. I had 10 hours and a generous advance with which to make a decision. Some research was in order. There was an internet cafe on the new concourse, opposite the sushi station where I'd made that first fateful encounter with Miss Warden. I headed there briskly, exchanging the briefest of nods with the pilots I passed along the way. Few of the faces were familiar, since I was strictly one of the day crowd. No one has much of a tan on Luna, but the night brackets were pasty, even by Ritsuko standards. Walking through the place was like coming to your high school reunion to find it haunted by the ghosts of all your life's ambitions. I chose a nondescript booth with a working terminal and sat down, leaning close to the screen. I waved my chipped hand over the sensor on my right, and a paper cup dropped into the hopper underneath, filled a moment later with watery black coffee. This formality over with, the terminal unlocked access to the internet. I'd gathered from school history that the big push for space colonization began in earnest after pollution was left unchecked for too long, and it was begrudgingly realized that snot yellow was not a healthy look for what was ostensibly blue sky. After everyone with any sense cleared out, the only people left on Earth were the planetary equivalent of rabid nationalists, whose best argument for staying was, "It's Earth." They'd only gotten more insular and paranoid over time, so now most off-world traffic wasn't permitted to land. Off-world quantum tunnels were illegal, and there was little diplomatic communication. This rather underlined Jacques McKeown's popularity if his books had managed to make it down there, but the point was Henderson could have been the god emperor of the entire Northern Hemisphere and most non-Terrans wouldn't know. A quick search for Henderson produced results almost immediately, and I read with one finger to my lips, my concerns swelling and growing like tulip bulbs. A cursory glance at the suggested words list would have raised eyebrows enough. The top three were awful, bastard, and arg. On the first page of results alone, the name was being linked to everything from food rationing scams to assassination syndicates, that grinning orange face beaming forth from the attached news stories like some kind of overseeing Satsuma. I knew this much about Earth's politics. The walled-off United Republic was the only remaining government, which spent half its time diligently maintaining order through judicious use of secret holding camps, and the other half accusing a token and ineffectual opposition party of being less than mouth-foamingly patriotic at all times. Everywhere else was a near lawless swarm of former countries, wiping more and more of each other off the map with every water war. I'd assumed that Henderson operated from one of the latter, but the surprise was that all the stories were coming out of the UR. My understanding was that you couldn't wipe a bogey off on your bathroom mirror there without being arrested for obstructing a surveillance camera. Maintaining a crime syndicate there would require a terrifying amount of power and influence. And sure enough, I found a photo of Henderson smiling and shaking hands with one of the previous puppet presidents, who looked rather pale and nervous. But then next to Henderson, everybody did. I leaned back. Crossing the black was seeming more and more like an option. I sighed. I'd hate myself for it, but frankly I'd entertained the notion often enough that the plan was already fully formed in my head. Step one, cash out my entire account and invest in enough food and shiny objects to impress one of the less psychotic pirate families. Step two, cut out my identity chip with a staple remover. Step three, clutch my hand and swear a lot. Alternatively, there was always Cantra Bargid, or one of the other primitive extrasolar worlds I'd saved. But the problem with living somewhere that knows you as a war hero is that that's kind of what you have to continue being. I'd be safe from my current enemy list among the Zavirons, but not so much from their endless plying tournaments. My thoughts stopped with a jarring clang when my eye caught the bar running along the top of the terminal screen. Current user, Jacques McKeown, it read. I'd been hearing that bracket name so often in the last few days, I'd barely noticed it at first, but now it had finally sunk in that this was a context where the name did not belong. I glanced at the scanner above the coffee maker, my guts still on the fence over whether to start churning or not. I passed my chip over it again. A second cup plopped into the one that was already there, spraying unpleasant pseudo-coffee. I glanced at the screen again. New user, Jacques McKeown. I swiped my chip back and forth a few more times, and the same message dutifully flickered across the screen again and again. The hopper vomited a small avalanche of paper cups, scalding my thigh with coffee routinely kept at bacteria-killing temperatures. But I was only half aware of it. Something in my gut was now decisively going at it with a pneumatic churning device. "Excuse me, sir," said a pretty young barista, uneasily appearing behind me with hands clasped behind back. "You are actually required to drink that coffee. The company signed an agreement with the city's waste processing..." She was about college age, with her black hair tied back in a ponytail. I stared at her, momentarily unable to speak, some coherent part of my mind silently praying that she wouldn't notice the thing she, of course, noticed immediately. Her words died in her throat as she looked past me at the computer screen, and the two of us goggled together for a second. "Oh my God," she said, in a dangerously flat tone. I noticed a power-off button on the monitor and none too subtly tried to slap it as I stood and turned around. "Yes, I did make quite a mess, didn't I? I'll find a towel immediately." I made an attempt to leave that she stepped in the way of with no apparent conscious thought. "Jacques McKeown," she squeaked. I pantomimed looking behind me over the wall of the booth, briefly noticing that a few star pilots' heads were already staring in my direction. "Where? Was he over there?" I said loudly, enunciating as clearly as I could manage. "I'll go over and have a look for you." "You're Jacques McKeown! The computer said your name's Jacques McKeown!" I ducked out of sight of the other star pilots. I was definitely hearing some interested muttering from over there. My current approach wasn't paying off, so I decided to try working with rather than through. "I'd really appreciate it if you kept your voice down about it," I said, holding my hands out. "It's like a secret identity thing, right?" She nodded rapidly. Her face had gone very red. "Of course, of course. Listen, I know this must be annoying, but my friend Kimmy, she's over there, she is such a huge fan of your books. Could I just quickly bring her over? This will make her completely freak." I made another abortive effort to leave. "Look, I don't want to cause a complete freak. I'm not sure how I could live with the guilt." "No, no, no, it's fine. I won't give you away." "Kim!" She called over to another female employee on the other side of the cafe, who seemed to be functionally identical to her. "There's someone here you will just freak out when you meet!" "Is it Jacques McKeown?" replied Kim, easily matching the first girl's volume. He doesn't want me to say!" bellowed the first girl. I didn't pay attention to the rest of the exchange, because by then I was speed-walking out of the concourse, having slipped away the moment the first girl's back had turned. The important thing was to not look like I was fleeing for what could very well be my life. I kept my head down, my hands in my jacket pockets, and concentrated on putting distance between me and the food court. I was half certain that an uncouth, pilot-esque voice shouted something, but I didn't dare stop or turn around. Fortunately, I was not the kind of star pilot who did business in a cape or a silver jumpsuit. A flight jacket and peaked pilot's cap could disappear into any spaceport crowd, as long as I serpentined a bit and broke line of sight a few times. When I'd reached the central plaza where the old and new concourses met, I hadn't yet felt an angry hand clamp around my shoulder, so I ducked into the gap between two vending machines and pretended to be checking my phone. Out of the corner of my eye, I saw somebody run into the middle of the circular floor, then falter, glancing around. I could feel sweat gathering hotly about my nose and forehead, until my pursuer made a frustrated noise and kept running in a randomly chosen direction. I took stock. I thought back to the strangely elaborate motions Miss Warden had been making with her tablet while paying me. She must have done something to have my name changed on the chip ID register. Rather an impish prank for a woman who smiled as comfortably as a camel breakdanced. If I could just get to my ship, I could be out of danger within the hour. Once I was through the trebuchet gate and hooked up with a pirate clan or on Cantrabarjid, I could forget about my current array of problems and concentrate on the inevitable new ones. Resuming my head-down, hands-pocketed walk, I made my way through the old concourse to the bay where the Never-Die was parked. I wasn't as worried about being spotted. No tourists came through here, and therefore no star pilots loitered, only ever passing quickly back and forth between their ships and the Quantunnel arrivals area. Nevertheless, I kept the shadows formed by piled-up crates and landing legs, and the Never-Die was soon in sight. I tried to think about what I would do if I were any other pilot with reason to believe that Jacques McKeown was in the spaceport. I'd probably start by punching my open palm a few times. Not too much to worry about. Then what? Without more concrete details, I personally probably wouldn't go out of my way to act on it. Not if it meant leaving my spot. That running person in the entrance plaza might not even have been after me. I was probably worrying over nothing. I fingered my keyring remote, in the vain hope that maybe for once I wouldn't have to manually pull the airlock door open, but no such luck. The door didn't budge, although the boarding steps unfolded wonkily from underneath, clattering heavily onto the concrete. Of course, there was one thing that I might consider trying, just to appease my curiosity. "That your ship, mate?" And that would be to check the parking registry, and see if any docked ships were registered to Jacques McKeown. Frozen, with one foot on the first boarding step, I wondered, exasperatedly, why the chip ID system had to be integrated with plying everything. Behind me was a group of around 5 or 6 star pilots, none of whom I recognized. They were all part of the night shift crew. As one, they stepped out from the shadow of the ship next to mine, watching me with varying degrees of neutrality in their facial expressions. "Yes," I said, prolonging the word as my mind raced. I was still holding the door remote, so a denial would have immediately lost me credibility. They hadn't immediately set upon me, so there was still room for doubt. The man who'd spoken was a completely bald, craggy-faced star pilot in a cap and flight jacket virtually identical to mine. He was holding a crowbar and making a half-hearted effort to keep it concealed behind his leg. "It's nice," he said, nodding slowly. "Cost you much?" It did when I bought it," I said, trying to look more bemused than terrified. "About 10 years ago." 10 years ago," parroted a taller star pilot to the speaker's left, wearing a red tunic with faded gold trim. Someone else in the throng made a sarcastic, appreciative whistling noise. "Must be hard to pay upkeep on a ship that old," said the first speaker. He had his face thrust forward toward me, wearing the kind of confrontational expression that makes you look like you're trying to dislodge a stubborn toffee from the roof of your mouth. "Got a lot of money coming in, then?" I didn't like the direction things were taking. The situation called for a derailing. I closed my eyes, flicked my imaginary switch, and felt my confident persona flush through my body, right to the tips of my fingers, which immediately flew to my face. "Oh my God, I'm so sorry. Is this your space?" The spokesman's brow furrowed, making him lose his confrontational toffee aspect. "You what?" I allowed myself to look convincingly frightened, which was not difficult. "Look, I don't want any trouble. Just hear me out. I couldn't afford to cover bay rental this week, and I had to make a landing, and I saw the empty space, and I thought I could just drop in and out before..." Wait, interrupted the spokesman. "You aren't the one registered for this bay?" Some members of the throng were starting to look reassuringly disappointed, but I couldn't let it slip, even for a moment. "No," I said, bemused. "Isn't that what this is about?" "He's not McKeown," said the tall bracket. If I had let it lie there, turned around, laboriously yanked the airlock door open, and boarded the Never-Die, things would have turned out so very differently. But I was afraid of dropping the innocent, unconnected star pilot act, and I knew that any star pilot, even an innocent and unconnected one, would have been intrigued by the sound of that bracket's name. McKeown? Why would you think I was McKeown? The spokesman stopped half-concealing the crowbar and started fondling it inoffensively, which was encouraging. "Some doint online has been bragging about how he's going to meet Jack McKeown in person," he said. "And someone said they saw him in the spaceport tonight, and his name's on this bay." I looked down at the square region of concrete that the Never Die occupied. Serious? Why would he do that? He'd be lynched. Nobody had moved from their spots, but some of them turned and relaxed their shoulders in ways that changed the situation from a confrontation with a mob to a relaxed discussion between friends. "Yeah, that's what I said," said the tall pilot, looking pointedly at a small chap off to the side. "He was in the cafe, I swear," said the small chap. "He was still logged in. And you know what that rich bracket did? He bought like 6 coffees. Just to rub our noses in how much coffee he could buy. Didn't even drink the plying things. Just spilled them all down his front." His sentence slipped away from him as he glanced down at my crotch. One by one, the pilots' heads tilted downward like a row of switches on an old-fashioned control panel. I followed their gaze and saw a large coffee stain on the front of my jeans, still wet and glistening. "Ah," I began. The body language of a mob came back, along with the crowbar. "I told you," said the small pilot excitedly. "I knew he had to be one of the plying daytime mob." There were any number of logical arguments I could have made. I could have reminded them of what we just discussed, that it made absolutely no logical sense for the real Jacques McKeown to use that name in his personal dealings, least of all in a place full of people who fantasized nightly about force-feeding him his own books. I could even have come clean and explained that someone had changed my name on the Chip ID database in aid of a long con at a wealthy Terran's expense. It was the kind of classic fable that may have appealed to their mindset. But show me a man who thinks that reason will work on an angry mob, and I'll show you a man who could be carried away in several standard business-sized envelopes. Instead, I held my hands up in a placatory kind of way and made myself look unconcerned. "Maybe you guys should back off before you do something you regret," I said. Then I focused my gaze on something behind them and injected just the right amount of satisfied relief into my voice. "Wouldn't you agree, officer?" The pilots collectively spun around. Security at the spaceport was no joke, since they had very little tolerance for anything that might spoil a visitor's first impressions of Ritsuko City, and had to be capable of dealing with people like Angelo. The smallest of the rookie night watchmen looked like he could bench-press a Pestilon desert cow. Fortunately for the belligerent pilots, he wasn't there, and by the time they turned back around, neither was I. Chapter 7. This time I just ran. Looking innocent was no longer as viable as simply putting distance between me and my colleagues as quickly as possible. There was shouting behind me, but I didn't dare glance back. I wove between the forest of landing legs and stacks of cargo crates, to use the word wove generously. Obstacles slammed my shoulders repeatedly and sent me careening in a vaguely consistent direction like a pinball. With every muscle pulsating with pain, I glanced rapidly around, seeking a security guard to hide behind. But in accordance with my current run of luck, the guards that appeared with such reliability every time I was looking for a place to stick my used chewing gum were nowhere to be seen. I reached the entrance plaza, neatly hopping the wrong way sign without slowing. There were no guards here either, just some startled visitors waiting for a late-night rickshaw. Why the hell weren't there guards at the entrance plaza? It was literally the first plying place a terrorist would be. Surely they hadn't been paid off to look the other way for the night. They took pride in being incorruptible, which just meant that their prices were very high. Way too high for a group of star pilots with strict budgets for hydrogen fuel. I hadn't stopped at any point while thinking this, but my speed had faltered, and the sound of several pairs of running feet and shouted mathematical terms was getting louder. I put my mind back to sprinting in the direction I was already facing, which happened to be toward one of the sets of glass entrance doors. When I had hurled myself toward them, and was about 6 inches from impact, It occurred to me that these doors might have been locked. They did lock some of the doors at night to reduce the foot traffic they needed to monitor when less staff were around. So the best scenario in that case would be me occupying the same general space as hundreds of shards of broken glass, or more likely bouncing off and falling straight back into the same general space as several fast-moving fists and boots. I made what effort I could to slow down in the 6 inches remaining, but the doors swung open under my forearms, unlocked. Disoriented, I stumbled right out into the street, was narrowly missed by one cyclist, and was sent spinning on my heel by another. Very few residents drive cars in Ritsuko City, or in off-world colonies generally. In a bubble city's enclosed atmosphere, air pollution from vehicle emissions couldn't be written off as the next generation's problem. I strung together whatever parts of my conscious mind were still functioning, and managed to dodge my way to the far side of the road. Once there, I dropped my knees in a convenient patch of grass. I didn't think the other pilots would follow me out into the open. There was no dignity in public scuffling, and we had precious little of that left. I looked behind me anyway. Unbeplying leaveable, they were still there. Not only that, but they'd picked up a few more faces along the way, still spilling out of the spaceport's main entrance. Most of them were hopping from foot to foot on the roadside, waiting for a break in bicycle traffic. Something that looked very much like a beer bottle was hurled toward me and bounced jarringly off the helmet of a random cyclist. I slammed the rough ground with the palms of my hands, just because I wasn't in quite enough pain yet, and shakily resumed running. I realized that, perhaps unconsciously, I was running for the functioning Quantunnel booth I'd used before, in the middle of the pleasant pedestrian precinct opposite the spaceport. That made sense. I could transport myself to any other location on Luna, literally any of which would be an improvement, as long as I closed the door behind me. The booth was in sight now, mercifully unattended, and I put whatever energy I had left into the sprint. Wait, I thought, keying in a destination would take time. Time that, judging by the sound of distressed grass coming from behind me, I did not have. The Quantunnel booth only represented an upright, solid object into which I would soon be stomped by 100 angry feet. Unless... Still running, I fumbled with my keyring until I had separated my keys and spaceship remote from a narrow plastic tag printed with the words U-Store Storage Solutions. I had no idea if it would even still work, but since my chances weren't going to get much slimmer, I spun it a few times and flung it toward the booth. My aim was dead on. The tag, along with the rest of my keyring, bounced off the large metal plate on the lower part of the booth's control panel. In that moment, a green light blinked on, registering the ID number encoded in the tag, and the booth connected conveniently to a preset destination. I rolled as I reached the booth, neatly recovering my keyring from the ground as I did so, and passed under the shutters as they opened, scraping my back on the 2 sheets of metal. Then, in 2 quick, smooth movements, I turned myself around, grabbed the inner shutter, and pulled it down to the ground. An angry fist banged upon the other side as I leaned on the shutter with all my strength, keeping it pinned in place. It took me a few moments of panting adrenaline come-down to notice that I was in pitch blackness. Keeping 1 foot holding the shutter down, I fumbled at the smooth rock walls to either side of me and found the light switch. The ceiling was so low that the light bulb immediately started warming my shoulder. My amazement that the light battery hadn't run out was swiftly replaced by my amazement that my card had still been valid. For some time after quantum tunneling became part of the public sector, innovators in every field of business, with the obvious exception of mine, were finding new uses for it daily. It was the U-Store Storage Company that first came up with the idea of firing small Quantunnel gates below the surface of Luna, carving out 5-foot cubes of rock far underground, selling the stone to building suppliers, and renting out the resulting cube-shaped spaces for storage. Like virtually everyone else on Ritsuko, I'd rented one. They gave you a plastic tag encoded with the location of your space, and then you could access your possessions from any commercial Quantunnel booth in the universe. I was surprised that my tag still worked, because I hadn't paid the rental fees in months. They'd even stopped sending me threatening email. I'd assumed they'd given up, cancelled the tag and auctioned off all my stuff. I glanced around the tiny space. Nope, it was all still here. A few cardboard boxes and an ancient bar fridge from my flight school days that my former housemates had insisted I take away. Maybe they hadn't gotten around to the auction. Or maybe they had simply forgotten about me after I stopped drawing attention to myself with late payments. More angry fists were hitting the shutter behind me. Someone made an effort to pull it open, so I stomped it down hard with both heels. My mind raced for a solution. Then it hit me that if all my stuff was still here, then that would include... Feet still keeping the shutter down, I leaned over and tore the parcel tape from the topmost box, then feverishly opened the flaps. There it was, beside the medal I received for saving the Skurobo people, and cushioned by several crumpled letters from individual Skurobos inviting me to visit. They were a needy bunch. My old blaster pistol. I weighed it in my hand, reminiscing. Back when I had spent my days adventuring through the galaxy, it had been a constant reassuring weight on my hip, like a clingy child in a crowded shopping mall. I'd had to put it in storage when I started spending all my time in the spaceport. Security wasn't exactly over the moon, ha-ha, about putting up with hordes of destitute star pilots. They took an even dimmer view of us exercising the right to open carry. And they doubly wouldn't be big on the illegal modification my gun had. Originally, it had had two settings, stun and kill. These had proved inadequate against the ridiculously well-armored skin of monsters from particularly rough planets, so I'd found a way to tinker with the built-in limitations. The dial now had a third setting, labeled with the handwritten words, "Solve all immediate problems." The important thing was that there was still charge in the ammunition cell. Not much, but enough to change the dynamic of the situation. Those pilots out there had come straight from the spaceport's secure area, and therefore wouldn't have been carrying any guns. I checked that all the blaster's parts were in order, and held it close to my face as I crouched and prepared to open the latch. All was silence out there, but I doubted my lynch mob had given up. They must have seen me use the U-Store tag, so they knew I had no other way out, and were almost certainly lying in wait. I didn't have the charge to shoot all of them, but ideally I wouldn't fire it at all. I'd just step out, make it clear who did and who didn't have a gun, and we'd all discuss things like sensible people. I puffed out my cheeks and tightened my grip on the gun. Open shutter, step out, wave gun, talk sensibly. Easy. I closed my eyes, opened the shutter, took a step forward, and then my face bounced painfully off a solid wall of moon rock. Okay, this was smart. The interior of U-Store storage spaces didn't have control panels, so users couldn't do something incredibly stupid, like deactivate the tunnel while inside the space and become trapped forever in a ready-made tomb hundreds of feet below the lunar surface. But there were ways that a spiteful person could deactivate it from outside, thanks to a design flaw now removed from the newest booths. Quite a hellish way to die, and an effective revenge. I wondered which one of them had thought of it. I bit my lip as hard as I could to stop myself from going immediately into jumping up and down hysterics, which in this space would probably have resulted in brain damage. I sat down heavily on the nearest box and was only half aware of the hard-earned awards for heroism from 100 different cultures being squashed, snapped, and broken. In sitting down, I felt my phone pressing against my hip. I couldn't remember the last time I'd charged it, but to my relief there was a good 10% of battery life. So I wasn't going to die, or at least not here, alone and forgotten, entombed with 100 broken treasures of no worth to anyone but myself. Shame. Would have been a fitting end. Quantum tunneling had left its pernicious influence on the telecommunications industry as well, so I could now call anyone in the universe, except my parents, or any other stubborn elderly bracket who just could not be persuaded to upgrade to a QT-supported phone. The next matter was thinking of someone to call, who would not be waiting for me on the other side of the shutter with a baseball bat. That meant I couldn't call any star pilots. I couldn't be sure that any of my fellows would completely dismiss the idea that I was Jack McKeown. And that was when I started worrying again, because my phone pretty much only held contact numbers for star pilots. None of my old friends among people I'd saved on extrasolar planets were sophisticated enough to have phones, let alone quantonal booths. That's why someone like me could impress them with nothing but an aging ship and a modified blaster pistol. I started frantically scrolling down my contacts list. Pilot, 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 dead, pilot, in prison, pilot, pilot, gone native, Frobisher. There was a thought. Frobisher was more of a friend than most, and no longer a pilot. What's more, hadn't I told him that I was being asked to impersonate someone before anyone had even started throwing names like Jack McKeown about? I called his number, mindful that, were I not planning to flee the solar system, he would never let me hear the end of this. No answer. Of course, it was quite late, and as one of my few sensible friends, Frobisher would be asleep, not out looking for clients, drinking, or getting locked in storage units. I called again, in the hope that maybe the last ring had woken him up and he needed further prompting. Nothing. I checked my phone's charge. 6% left. Did I really want to use it all up, putting all my eggs in this basket? I could have left a voicemail, but it hardly seemed like a solution, since I would suffocate to death before he heard it. I kept scrolling. I was reaching the end of the alphabet and starting to sweat, when I saw an entry that had been highlighted to indicate that it was newly added. It simply said, Warden. Not only did she know full well that I was not really Jack McKeown, but this entire situation was directly her fault. It would practically be her duty to rescue me. The problem, though, was that this would go against my original plan, which was to get the track away from the entire Henderson situation. I tapped my phone against my knee, thinking. Perhaps succumbing to death was the way to go after all. It's not like I hadn't lived a full life. The box of objects currently disintegrating beneath my arse attested to that. Maybe it was time to lie down and let this brave new quantunneling universe go on without my burden. Doinks to that. 37 is not the right sort of age for embracing euthanasia. There were still hours before I had to report to Henderson. I'd just get rescued by Warden, then excuse myself, and pick the right moment to attempt legging it again. I called her number. Warden, came her impatient voice after four rings. Hello, please spare me the chatter. State your reason for contacting me. I only hesitated for a moment. A bunch of star pilots chased me into a U-Store booth and shut off the tunnel. I am currently trapped underground and I need rescuing. Why did they do this? Because they think I'm Jack McKeown. The words triggered something in my head. And why did you change my name to Jack McKeown, you crazy div? Henderson took your wine glass from the restaurant, she said, keeping her voice as flat as possible. He intended to fingerprint you to confirm your identity. You are very lucky that I was able to get the change made in time. I have had to exert influence over some people at the ID Network's administrative facility. It was a maddeningly sensible reason, but she could easily have been lying to cover up her psycho-div control-freak head games. I think you mean that we're both very lucky, I pointed out. Considering what Henderson would do to you if I get found out. Do not think that that gives you power, Mr. McKeown. This, I decided, was one of those pick-your-battles situations. I dropped the matter. I'm sending you the access code for my U-Store space. Can you open it from a quantonal booth away from the spaceport and let me out? How long have you been in there? What? I don't know. 10 minutes? But you said you were chased inside, so I assume you had an elevated heart rate for a while. Has that come down to a normal level? I frowned, confused. Physically I'm fine, I'm just trapped. I could hear paper rustling in the background. Those U-Store spaces average about 5 feet cubed, correct? Yeah, they're all pretty standard, And the contents, besides yourself? How much of the space has been filled? A third, maybe? Why the track are you asking me that? I heard the faint sound of scribbling, and then of a stylus clattering triumphantly onto a data pad. I'd say on the low end that you have around 4 hours and 30 minutes of oxygen left. Right. So, in which case, you can expect rescue in 4 hours and 25 minutes. Before replying, I clenched my fists as hard as I could and counted slowly to 5. I would really appreciate it if you could drop the Psychodiv revenge one-upmanship for 1 second. I am asking you to rescue me from a deadly situation that you got me into. Don't misunderstand me. My time is very tightly scheduled, and several equally urgent matters currently require my attention. Like what? Firstly, I have to spend the night faking a lengthy correspondence of emails between us, in case Henderson checks into it. Secondly, I am currently only wearing my underwear. You called in the middle of the shoot, and it was extremely difficult to hire a cameraman and a lighting engineer at this time of night. I blinked a few times. You know, most people would have just recorded it by themselves, I suggested, with a phone camera or something. That attitude, Mr. McKeown, is why I am the personal assistant to the richest and most powerful man in the solar system, and you are going to be spending the rest of the night trapped in a U-Store facility. Chapter 8. The ceiling light was programmed to wink out every few minutes, making the assumption that the user had enough sense to not be inside after the tunnel connection was closed, and I made a conscious decision not to keep turning it back on. It would be wiser not to exert myself, and it decreased the chances of me smashing my head against the ceiling. My phone's battery lasted to about halfway through the first word of my voicemail message to Frobisher. Then the screen died and I was alone, on an uncomfortable box, in pitch blackness and silence, with one solitary Psychodiv, the only person in the universe aware of my plight. With no means of telling the time, paranoia set in. After what, in retrospect, was probably only the first hour, I became convinced that my remaining 3.5 hours had been and gone. As even more time passed, I grew more and more certain that Warden was not going to keep her promise and rescue me. It was like Frobisher said, if I would do for a last-minute replacement, anyone would. Oh, sure, she'd introduced me to the Hendersons as McKeown, but they were Terrans, and Terrans were all self-absorbed trackheads who couldn't tell one Lunarian from another. It was all that high gravity they had down there, squashing their brains in. She'd probably finished her shoot and gone straight down to the spaceport again to grab the closest, vaguely similar bracket in a flight jacket. There was absolutely no shortage, leaving me here to die. And as the air grew thin and death became a tangible reality, the philosophical attitude I had displayed earlier disappeared in impotent, childish rage. I didn't want to die, not in an inescapable 5-foot cube. I wanted to be in my cockpit again, with infinity stretching off in all directions, beyond one slim layer of plexiglass. Here, now, my frustrated mind seeking desperately for exits that did not exist, I was thinking clearly for the first time in years. If I could have been allowed to live just a little longer, I wouldn't have gone back to the spaceport, struggling every day to make money because I couldn't move on from the past. I was going to find a new golden age for myself. I leapt to my feet, then sat suddenly back down again after nearly braining myself on the ceiling. Ply tourists, ply Mr. Henderson, ply Jacques McKeown, and ply piracy for that matter. I'd forge my own path, set out into the black, do what I used to do, help people less fortunate than myself, make a difference. I'd work to make the universe better if I could only have just a little bit more life. At that point, I think I must have been throwing myself around the room, because the next thing I remember is flying toward the shutters and them rattling open just as I did so. I stumbled and landed on my back, sliding across a tiled floor before coming to rest with my head against what felt like a high-heeled shoe. I blinked until my blurred vision had cleared up, and I could see the disapproving face of Miss Warden, silhouetted against a bright fluorescent ceiling light. She was back in the pantsuit she had worn when we'd first met, unless she had several identical ones, which would not have surprised me in the least. "Your first day at work has begun, Mr. McKeown," she said, looking at me over her omnipresent data pad. "Ugh." I sat up a little too quickly, and it didn't feel like all of my brain had come for the ride. "I am not ready for this." "Nevertheless," said Warden primly, "you know what? I think I forgot something in there." I made an attempt to scuttle back through the shutters, but Warden stepped smartly over me and pulled something out of the Quantunnel booth's console, causing the shutters to slam down. I pawed uselessly at the ridged metal. "This way," she said, trotting along the corridor without looking to see if I was following. I took a moment's pause to lean on the side of the Quantunnel booth and pinch my eyes a few times, then jogged after her to catch up. "Don't suppose it matters to you that I genuinely thought I was going to die in there," I said. She gave me a cold look. "Then consider yourself inducted into the Henderson organization." I followed her through a set of double doors into a bare corridor painted in beige, with visible pipes and cables running along the walls. More a transition between places than a place in itself, like the behind-the-scenes parts of a cruise liner, or the spaceport, I slurred aloud. "Tell me this isn't the spaceport." "Calm yourself," she sniffed, bobbing along on her high heels. "This is Mr. Henderson's private spaceport on the north side of Ritsuko City." "There's only one private spaceport in Ritsuko City. It's on top of the Yubatsu building. And the Yubatsu building is the new headquarters of Henderson Lunar and Extrasolar Enterprises." We passed through a set of double doors into a beautifully decorated connecting hallway with thick pile red carpeting, mahogany wood panelling on the walls, and the occasional artwork that bore the hallmarks of mass production. The whole place stank of fresh varnish and paint, and some of the stone busts of Roman emperors, placed at regular intervals against the walls, were still wrapped in transparent plastic. A cold dread gripped me as I realized that I was deep in the belly of the beast that was Henderson, and that immediate escape was looking less and less likely. I followed Warden toward a set of heavy airlock doors that I presumed led to some kind of landing bay. "Is Mr. Henderson around?" I probed. "No," she said, with just barely perceptible relief. "He has left it to me to see you and Daniel off. A lot of things currently require his attention. He has made the spontaneous decision to expand into off-world operations." "Take it you don't approve?" She stopped, startled by my statement, and turned. "What? What on earth makes you think that?" "I don't know, you just seemed like you didn't approve. Admittedly, I don't yet know what it looks like when you do approve of something, but I can take an educated guess." She leaned in so close I had to lean back a little. Her face was still neutral, but very red all of a sudden. "I am completely in support of all of Mr. Henderson's decisions. If your intention is to drive a wedge between me and my employer, then you will not succeed. Are we clear?" I glanced behind myself, in case there was some kind of agent provocateur standing there that she was addressing instead of me, then displayed my palms. "Crystal?" I said, baffled. Scowling, Warden placed her hand against a security scanner. A high-pitched hiss burst out from the hinges of the airlock door, which grew quickly into a roar of wind as the thick steel slowly parted, revealing the docking platform. The Yubatsu building was near enough the tallest building in Ritsuko City, which was a very competitive field. The nature of a bubble city ensures that there isn't much room for expanding outward, but expanding upward is always an option until you reach the legally enforced buffer zone between the city and the glass ceiling. Yubatsu reached as close to that buffer as it dared, and from the rooftop docking bay I felt I could throw a stone straight upward and watch it ping off the plexiglass shield. Then I saw the ship parked in the center of the bay, and froze where I was, midway through the doorway. My jaw hung loosely like a little hammock, in which my tongue tossed restlessly as I sought the words. After Quantunling started tearing the transport industry apart, most shipbuilders realized that there wouldn't be much money in selling practical designs anymore. Not the kind of ships star pilots favored, sleek and maneuverable with plenty of missile tubes and fast enough engines to outrun enemy ships weighed down by too many missile tubes. No. All of a sudden, anything that merely desperately needed to get somewhere could be there at half the cost and zero time, so they couldn't make money selling ships for transportation anymore. Not long afterward, the only new ships getting built were luxury yachts that rich brackets used for vacation cruises. And with opportunities for commerce growing exponentially, there were a lot more of those rich brackets popping up. Everyone except star pilots was making money hand over fist. Even street buskers looked down on each other if they couldn't hire a backing vocalist or two. And new money being what it is, ship designers competed for a while to create the ship that reflected the least possible amount of taste in its owner. They made pleasure ships with gold-plated hulls, custom nacelle rims, observation lounges with bar and karaoke facilities, and every single one would immediately brighten up the day of any pirate who happened upon them mid-flight. This became clear fairly swiftly, and decadence was toned back down a little in favour of a degree of practicality, so the newer ships tucked some plying fast engines in between all the jacuzzis. Daniel Henderson's brand new ship was not one of those. Mr. Henderson had presumably done very little research, and had chosen the ship on the basis of the best being the most expensive. The ship before me was the very one that many pirates had affectionately nicknamed the Dinner Bell. "Oh, Christ," I said, still staring. "It's the Corona Platinum God of Whale Sharks." Start with something shaped vaguely like a jar. A huge, thick, curvy jar with very few aerodynamic properties, the kind of thing they sell yeast extract in. Then make it the size of a house, so that its curved, spidery landing legs are visibly straining under the weight. Then find some way to give the jar a tumorous disease that covers it with observation bubbles, each housing a bedroom or some decadent facility or another. It's a very strange disease. Finally, cover the whole thing in highly polished metal, coloured a vibrant aquatic blue. Warden was beside me. Is it seriously called that? My gaze continued following the ship's bulky curves as I spoke, and my voice seemed to come from far away. Corona went through all the metals, silver class and gold class and platinum class. Then they went through titles, king class, emperor class, up to god class. Then they started using the names of fish. This was the last one Corona made before they started reining it in. "Yes, well, Mr. Henderson does have a tendency to indulge, Daniel," said Warden. I turned to her. "No, what I'm trying to say is this is a really, really bad ship to be cruising in. It's a death trap." One of her eyebrows sprang up like a gazelle hearing a tiger fart. "My understanding was that the manufacturer has a good reputation for preventing mechanical failures." "It's functional, yeah, but look at it. It might as well have a big sign trailing out the back saying, 'Pirates, please kill us and take all our stuff.' And it would only move like a whale shark if the whale shark was on dry land, in Earth gravity." "I see," said Warden, elongating the E. She looked up at the ship again and frowned. "I would remind you that you assured us that you were willing to fly, I think your exact words were, anything with at least one wing." I looked sadly at the ship's stubby wings. They looked about as conducive to flight as a cocktail stick lodged in a swan's throat. "Nobody flies these things anymore, I'm telling you."
"Ugh, I told you, Dad,"
said a familiar voice from surprisingly close behind.
"I told you you should have gotten me the red one."
Daniel had come out onto the bay by the same door we had, wearing a silvery flight suit of the kind some star pilots still wore if they were too cheap to buy a shaving mirror. Henderson wasn't far behind, wearing a different reindeer-patterned sweater from the one he'd had the day before, combined with slippers and a pair of white shorts so short that were it not for the belt, I would have mistaken them for boxers. The creature known as Carlos was bringing up the rear, still wearing its specially tailored tuxedo, like an unusually formal set of goalposts.
"Good morning, Mr. McKeown," said Henderson, grinning like a shark. "You look..."
He hesitated as he took in my appearance, which had been done no favours by a night in a cave with no changes of clothing.
"Present? You were saying something about this very expensive ship I picked out?"
"He was saying it's lame," said Daniel,
just as I opened my mouth.
"He was saying that it's a load of multiplying subtraction."
He glanced at me as he used the words and seemed downhearted by my grimace of distaste. Mr. Henderson was still smiling, but there was a sadness in his eyes. As he locked gaze with me, he absent-mindedly picked wool pills off his reindeer sweater with his cassowary talon ring.
"Do tell us your professional opinion on the ship, Jack."
"It's so lame, isn't it, Jack?" said Daniel, nodding to himself. "Dad should have gotten me the red one, shouldn't he? God, he is so stupid, isn't he?"
This was probably a good time to start representing myself in this little negotiation. I made a loud throat-clearing sound that inadvertently came out sounding a bit squawk-like. "Obviously, it's a very sound purchase. That shade of blue is the very latest in aerodynamic innovation, I've heard, but this model does tend to get attacked by pirates a lot." Daniel's demeanour changed instantly. His eyes sparkled, although they could just have been reflecting the flight suit.
"Oh my God, you think we might see pirates? That would be so awesome."
"Well, I think that settles it," said Henderson, clapping his hands.
I don't think he'd been paying attention since his last contribution to the discourse.
"Have a nice time up in space, Danny, and I know you'll get lonely without your dear old dad, but know you've got the best star pilot in the universe to protect you."
He kissed the top of Daniel's head.
"Ugh, hate you,"
replied Daniel, out of reflex.
"I love you too," said Henderson,
smiling at me as Daniel made a particularly loud, embarrassed noise. Warden, who until this point had drifted into the background in a way that seemed to come very naturally to her, subtly drifted back out again. "Mr. Henderson, perhaps we should not entirely dismiss Mr. McKeown's feelings. The important thing is Daniel's safety, after all."
"Oh, I agree, Penny. That's why you're going with them."
Warden blinked twice. "Sir?"
"You wouldn't expect me to leave Danny alone with a complete stranger, would you? He might end up getting sold as meat to some planet of primitive alien scumbags. I need someone I can trust up there. More importantly, someone Daniel trusts."
"Yeah, it's fine. Can we go now?"
said Daniel petulantly. Warden looked at him, then at Henderson, then back to her pad, which provided no help.
"Mr. Henderson, I have a great many duties as your personal assistant."
"All taken care of, Penny. Cindy's taking over, aren't you?"
Carlos slid aside with a sort of stone-like grinding noise to reveal that a young woman had been behind him all along in a demonstration of background blending as yet unrivalled. She looked essentially identical to Warden, except younger and smaller by a factor of around 10%. She was also paler, and all her facial features seemed to be arranged with infinitesimal precision like a bone china tea set.
"Miss Warden," she said, clutching her own tablet.
"Miss Sternall," said Warden. An awful lot was being said in their curt greetings and locked gaze, to the point that I felt grateful that neither woman was holding a broken bottle.
"Mr. Henderson, with respect, Miss Sternall has not been my assistant long enough to fully grasp all the subtleties."
"Oh, she'll figure it out. I gave her all your login details,"
interrupted Henderson, waving a hand.
"Besides, you're getting promoted. Surprise!"
"To what role?" asked Warden, in the tone of one who had just been asked what form of execution they preferred.
"To head of Henderson Lunar and Extrasolar Enterprises. You couldn't expect me to be the one to oversee the operations. The thought of spending much more time in one of these off-world colonies makes me want to spit up blood.
I left some paperwork in your cabin. Check that over and you can get straight to it when you get back, yeah?
Can we go now? Suggested Danny,
whose repeated attempts to walk briskly into the ship had all been aborted when nobody had made any motion to follow.
I just need to stop back at the Quantanal booth, get my stuff out of storage, I said, pointing a thumb over my shoulder, uncomfortably aware of the tense stare-down still going on between Warden and Cindy.
No need, said Mr. Henderson firmly. The ship has its own onboard Quantanal booth. It's got all the mod cons, you know. Now, are there any last misgivings you wish to raise?
There was an impatient edge to his voice. Carlos, I noticed, could move pretty subtly when he wanted to. At some point he had moved to a point between me and the door by which I'd entered, responding to some shrewd instinct. When he saw me looking, he slowly folded his arms like a medieval fortress raising a pair of drawbridges. I gave in. No, boss, I muttered.
Good. I'm sure Danny will have nothing but wonderful things to tell me.
He patted me lightly on the shoulder, and I felt the little sting of an extended cassowary talon. I met his gaze, and it was a stark contrast to his tone of voice. After a moment he gave Warden the same look, and she swallowed quietly. Daniel pressed a shiny black remote that was still wrapped in a gift ribbon, and the airlock door hissed open with a smooth, almost seductive motion, folding down to form a set of shallow steps. Daniel walked reverently in, glancing back at Miss Warden, who was walking slowly and stiffly, as if her legs were moving with no apparent input from her conscious mind. Henderson and Cindy watched from the edge of the docking bay, waving with a varied mixture of earnestness and sarcasm. Carlos just stared, and I had a distinct impression that some part of his mind, buried somewhere in all that muscle, was taking meticulous notes. I followed Warden up the steps into the shining clean airlock, and a not unpleasant new ship smell reached my nostrils. I pressed the button to close the exterior door behind me, and appraised the two people I was now sharing an awkwardly small space with. Warden seemed frozen. Her expression hadn't changed since her stare-off with Cindy, and she was gripping the datapad with white knuckles. Daniel was staring at me like a hungry man regards a sandwich artist. My options were becoming fewer by the moment, I realized. I might have to kidnap them.
Chapter 9. I had to admit, the buyer of the Platinum God of Whale Sharks certainly got their money's worth. Assuming what they wanted to buy was a brief period of obscene luxury and comfort, followed by a prolonged one in the company of pirates. Daniel had immediately bolted off to inspect the bridge. Warden had drifted off on some errand of her own, and I was looking for the Quantanal booth. On the way, I found myself mentally cataloguing all the problems that would arise in an emergency situation. The walls were covered in decorated silver plating, and the floor with thick pile red carpeting, all of which would have to be hastily torn off if I needed to access components in the infrastructure. None of the interior doors locked, and there was no dedicated security or regroup room. I stumbled upon one of the observation lounges in my search, and not a single item of furniture, not the beanbag chairs or the snooker table or the karaoke machine, was bolted down. So in the event of gravity failure or depressurization, everything would go flying. The snooker table alone would rack up an impressive body count. In the back of a small reading room, packed with Jacques McKeown's entire body of work, naturally, I found the Quantanal booth. For one heartening moment, I thought I had found an obvious escape route, unsupervised, but the moment I booted up the interface and started searching for a destination, I was halted by a request for a passcode. Operation Kidnap was back on the table. Fortunately, all booths had to have unrestricted access to U-Store spaces, thanks to a law that was passed after one poor bracket was denied access to his medication, so I scanned my keyring tag and the shutters promptly opened. I toyed with the idea of sealing myself inside again, but swiftly dismissed the thought and instead recovered my gun.
After a little digging, I found my shoulder holster and put it on under my jacket. This, I decided, was a concealed carry situation. Overpowering Daniel I didn't see being much of a problem, but Warden would be something of an X factor. I'd have to take that datapad away from her for a start. I had a feeling that, at the first sign of ill intent, she'd use it to hack the universe and erase me from existence. I'd probably just have to wait until she was asleep, assuming she slept, and didn't just recharge herself from a wall socket every night. Once there was no one to interfere with where I took the ship, it would just be a matter of picking an amenable pirate family, going to their turf and being a bit too obvious. On this ship, that would be the easy part. It really was a boarding waiting to happen. A day ago, I had thought that being a pirate wasn't even a last resort. How naive I had been, way back before the multiple threats to my life, in which I included every individual second spent in the company of Mr. Henderson. It was a stark and hungry existence, even more so than charter piloting. At least then you could always live off abandoned meals in the sushi station, as long as you got there before the janitors. But at this point it was a matter of survival, and no one could blame me. Especially after the treatment I'd had at the hands of Warden. I pictured her explaining the situation to the police. He took me hostage until he could run off with a pirate gang, and you did nothing to provoke him, madam. No, apart from directly and indirectly threatening to kill him several times, and deliberately ruining his life, so that he was forced to run off with a pirate gang. That gave me pause for thought. I stopped in the middle of a connecting hallway. Escaping the ship and joining pirates really was a fairly obvious move on my part. Warden must have considered it. What if she'd already hacked the universe to make all the pirates want me dead, too? I heard a ladylike sigh of frustration that seemed very familiar, and noticed that one of the doors in the hallway was ajar. Through the crack I saw Warden sitting on the edge of a bed. A bed, naturally, not a recessed bunk, because large pieces of furniture are exactly what I love taking up floor space when I have to run to the bridge for an emergency course change. Inspecting the contents of a briefcase, which I assumed Henderson had left here for her. Right, this was an opportunity. I just had to start building the persona of a broken-down star pilot resigned to his predicament with absolutely no intention of moving in a piratey sort of career path. I rapped upon the door with two knuckles. Anyone in? What do you want? I took that as an invitation and pushed the door open wide, remaining in the door frame. In keeping with the rest of the ship, it was a very pleasant bedroom, straight out of a luxury hotel, with a wide circular viewing window representing another crucial weak point in the hull. Warden was facing away from me, still reading the paperwork in her hands. I flicked the little switch in my head and coughed politely. Hey, can't tell you how relieved I am that Henderson didn't want to tag along in person. She didn't look at me. You came in here to tell me that you can't tell me something. Not a promising start. If we keep our heads down, stay in the solar system within the reach of security services, I don't see the trip being a problem. What I was saying about pirates earlier, that was, you know, worst-case scenario talk, in case you were worried. I see. It's like how you have to turn your phone off before making a trebuchet jump. It's very, very unlikely to teleport us to an evil parallel universe, but anything we can do to reduce the chance? Don't let me keep you from the pre-flight checks, she said pointedly, still not turning to look at me. I felt I'd planted enough seeds of innocence for now. I turned to go. All right, see you later. And congratulations on the promotion, by the way. There was a rustling crash of paper in distress. I spun around. Warden was suddenly